Outlet Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to The Profile. I'm Justin Brierley, Senior Editor of Premier Christianity magazine, and this is the show where we bring you people in all kinds of walks of life to talk about their faith, about projects they're working on. And if you want to find more interviews with all kinds of interesting people, why not pick up a copy of the latest magazine? That's premierchristianity.com/free sample. You'll be able to find what we've got on offer lately. Well, today on the programme, I'm joined by Theo Hobson. He's the author of a new book, God Created Humanism, The Christian Basis of Secular Values, published by SBCK. Theo's going to be talking about that book and about his own life and faith journey as well. And if you want to hear today's programme as a podcast, don't forget you can now access The Profile as a podcast. Simply go online. I'll make sure to give you the ways to do that later on in the programme. But right now, Theo, welcome along to the programme.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you with me. I've read your stuff for a long time now. You've sort of been a journalist, a freelance journalist for a long time, writing for different papers and websites and so on. Was that something you wanted to do from an early point in your life?
I think it probably was. I've always been interested in thinking about religion. And I got involved in academic theology for a while, but it didn't quite suit me, so I sort of bounced back into a bit more kind of trying to communicate to a wider audience kind of writing. I think to begin with, actually, literature. So that was literature and theology together were my sort of big passions as a student, I suppose.
Yeah. Where did the faith thing come in for you? Was it something you were raised with? Was it something you discovered later on?
Yeah, I was definitely raised C of E, quite traditional, mainstream, partly through my school, kind of public school religion, with a Christian union, in fact, which got me very interested for a few years, but also a slightly more intellectually sort of interest. I started reading around certain theological issues, I think even while I was still at school, and in a way, a bit dissatisfied with sort of the normal package I felt I was being offered.
I mean, a lot of people grow up with some kind of an Anglican church-going background. Doesn't necessarily mean they keep it. Often, I've heard it said, in fact, that often a public school kind of religious upbringing gives you just enough religion to be inoculated against it for the rest of your life. But obviously, that wasn't quite the case for you. So what was it that kept you interested?
It's difficult to know. It was partly, I think, this Christian union at school that had a very intense form of community and fellowship.
Was it quite evangelical?
It was, but in that kind of quite liberal way of traditional public school Anglicanism. And I think that did show me that it could be an exciting, fun place to be, although I did, after a few years, kind of edge away from it stayed with me. But also just the more mainstream Anglicanism of local vicars and so on. I was always ambiguous about church going, which seemed rather boring and old-fashioned, but part of me was quite receptive to it and liked the ritual on some level and felt I'd probably come back to it, maybe to think about it, at least have one foot in it.
Did you ever sort of have a point where you didn't think you believed in God, or was it always sort of there, more or less?
I'd say kind of semi, you know, when I was kind of later teenage, I felt I was maybe a kind of enlightened semi-Christian who had moved a bit towards a more rational humanist version of religion. But I felt that the tradition was always something I'd be coming back to and that I was never going to make a clean sort of atheist break with it.
I mean, as you grew up and obviously met many people who wouldn't have shared your Christian faith, did that challenge you? Did you find any issues that you had to work through as you went along?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I suppose at school already, most of my friend group was kind of agnostic or atheist or quite sort of progressive socialist-y sort of people who had quite a sort of knee-jerk rejection of religion. And so I was very used to taking on that point of view and I suppose having a few arguments in which I probably put the case for religion, but at that point in a rather sort of half-hearted way.
Right. And I guess it just stayed with you, the fact that of that it, you say it kind of grounded.
Well, in fact, as an undergraduate, I had a sort of return to a more intense feeling for it. I was studying literature at a rather sort of secular university, and I suppose it put me on the spot of thinking, you know, am I into this or not? Mm. And in a sense, I felt a sort of pressure to drift away from it, partly to sort of fit in and be more attuned to my peers. And so I did feel at that point, I do need to make a sort of decision that this matters to me. And I suppose it was a difficult time of feeling, you know, somewhat alone in the first year of university. And that sort of contributes to rather intense self-examination.
Yeah.
And I began to become more passionately interested in theology, also on a existential level.
Right. Yeah. How did that manifest itself then? You were studying literature, but you did eventually go on to do some theology.
Yeah, I became kind of dissatisfied with literature as a subject, and most of my time was kind of reading up on theology, even though there wasn't a theology course at that university. So I had a pretty intense time of intellectual exploration, really, of looking into, I suppose, modern theology, and especially the liberal Protestant tradition, also the less liberal Protestant tradition. I was into things like Kierkegaard, I was into rather contrasting things like Tolstoy and socialist religion. So as I was trying to sort of find some sort of unity within quite diverse strands of religion for a few years. And then I went on to study theology as a postgraduate.
Hmm. Was there ever kind of in mind potentially ordination or some sort of calling to Christian ministry?
Well, I always did feel a little bit detached, actually, from church. You know, even though I had a sort of maybe conversion-y or reconversion-y experience, it didn't really send me back to community. So I was quite alone in a way with trying to work these things out. You know, I would go to church sometimes, but feel, you know, maybe this needs radical overhaul. Maybe I don't fit in. That sort of thing that a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. And ever since, it's been a little bit sort of tense and love-hate and finding my way in. But I have a couple of times felt that I wanted to be more conventionally serving of the church. I mean, I do go to church most of the time now.
Have you made your peace with church at this time?
To a large extent, yeah. Yeah, to a large extent. Only gradually, really, when I was sort of late 30s.
What changed, if anything did change?
It happened that I was living in New York a few years ago, and partly being away from my home country made me sort of feel the need for the basic sense of community, I think. Mm. So suddenly church going seemed something to embrace rather than feel tension with and kick against half the time. And I thought, yeah, this is really my home, even though I'm still interested in having, you know, one foot outside and being semi-detached. It's still a sort of base and it's my core culture.
Do you think there are quite a few people like you who have that same sort of love-hate relationship with the church?
Yeah, I think there are. I think it is a difficult place to be. Because it's not an easy culture to fit in with. And to be honest, a lot of church culture does not feel like good enough culture. It doesn't feel engaging enough. It doesn't feel creative enough. And so when one goes to a local church, one feels guilty about saying it, but one might be thinking, this isn't quite this isn't quite right for me. Mm. I need something different. Mm. And it's hard to make sense of that because on one level, of course, one should humbly join in and serve and, you know.
And no church is going to meet all your expectations, I suppose, is it?
That's right. On one level, you do have to be realistic and say, maybe this is something I should get involved with. But on another level, maybe one should preserve that slightly edge of dissent and wanting something different.
Yeah. And for you, the Anglican Church obviously is a very broad church in terms of the kinds of types of people and theology and churchmanship you find in it. Would you say you've settled in a fairly sort of liberal, I don't know, Anglo-Catholic type tradition? What's been your home?
That's basically my sort of home tradition. But that's, as you say, itself quite a broad church. There are some people with more emphasis on the liberal reformism, mm-hmm. on certain social and political issues. That's not quite my thing. There's some people who get very into the ritual in quite a conventional form of ritual way. I suppose I've been trying to find a sort of niche within it, which is partly about an interest in ritual, but partly about trying to find a new creative way to do that, mm. and try to find sort of artsy ways to rethink ritual. I've also become more interested in doing art and making art, and that's part of my attempt to engage with church. So I've been looking for ways in which we can somehow renew that sacramental tradition.
And I'm sure you've got many peers of your generation who didn't stick with church, even though they might have had some connection with church growing up and so on, as you did.
Yeah.
Do you think that the approach you've tried to explore is something that could draw people back who have maybe think that church is irrelevant or outdated or whatever it might be?
I hope so. But on the other hand, one should be realistic that that's quite an uphill struggle, because there is something about church, about Christian worship, that is different and other, and it seems strange. And in a way, you can't get rid of that.
No.
It's going to seem, in a way, shockingly strange to the secular mind that people are saying these psalms. And
do your secular friends still think you're a bit weird for continuing to kind of hold on to church?
Yeah, I think a lot do. But I suppose they've got used to it.
He's the God botherer of the...
Well, sort of. I don't know. I'm not quite a conventional God botherer, but yeah, maybe.
I mean, I know that you've got a friendship with Alain de Botton, and he's been trying to do stuff around regaining community in a secular age that maybe we lost as we've lost church-going traditions and that kind of community that's formed. Do you think there's anything in that, you know, atheism 2.0, as he's called it, the idea of keeping some of the trappings that religion gave us for community's sake, but losing the supernatural dimension?
No, I'm not very impressed by that, to be honest. It's not quite my cup of tea.
Sorry, Alan.
Yes, I think he's quite an interesting writer. I think that, well, it's interesting in that it shows a desire for religious traditions and forms that persists within a lot of thinking agnostics. But I think it's, in a sense, an evasion of the issue to sort of try and create pseudo-religious forms in an agnostic way. You know, I'd rather people like him would engage with a real thing, in a sense, rather than trying to create that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, for you, what's the core for you of your Christian faith? What, you know, if someone asked you, simply explain why you're a Christian, what would it actually consist in?
Well, I suppose it partly comes down to a kind of something a bit like social idealism, political idealism. I think that's, in a way, the thing that really hooked me in as a student, of a desire for the perfect society, in a way. Mm. That kind of semi-Marxist kind of vision of we do desire this perfect form of life, of human life, and it all goes wrong in secular attempts to do it, but there is something within the Christian tradition that works, that preserves the purity of that desire and creates it in local forms, in realistic forms and forms that admit they're fallible, but that do express a form of perfectionism in a sense. Mm. And it's about a moral perfectionism that we see revealed in Christ that is available to us on one level. Mm. That we're as fallible humans, we're going to not create heaven on earth, but we are going to keep striving for it. Yeah. And that feels like the true tradition.
It sounds a lot then like the way you engage with Christianity, and the reason for your Christian faith is at one level, it's not so much a kind of personal me and God and my salvation. It's more a, this is the way we change the way that we create the kind of society that we need.
Yeah, well, there is also a more personal level. Maybe it's something in me that I sort of first talk about at the more social level. Yeah. But of course, as at that time of being an undergraduate, it was a very personal, existential thing of this is also the way towards psychological wholeness, towards avoiding despair and depression, and this is the way in which we can be free of those sort of things and our true selves through having this rather strange phenomenon of faith in God.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, faith, personal faith is also very central.
And when it comes to others who maybe haven't gone the same route as you, what kind of worldviews do you find them inhabiting, and the ways that they're looking to improve society? Or are they even thinking along those lines? Not people aren't necessarily haven't thought about the big picture.
That's a good question, I think. And it's a really big issue for, you know, people who are trying to be Christian these days, is that probably you're going to know a lot of people who are very impressive humanists, who are agnostics, but are at least as good as you at seeming to pursue the right things and to be decent people, maybe in some ways better than oneself. And that's a difficult thing to make sense of, I suppose, that how come they didn't feel the need for this tradition and this form of culture and this myth. But it seems that's how our society has evolved, and the way I've come to see it is that Christian values have spilt out into the secular humanist realm, and that a lot of people access them like that, and in a sense don't feel the need for the Christian base of them.
Right.
So I think that's how I'd make sense of that.
So this takes us to the subject of the book, of course, which is called God Created Humanism, which is quite a provocative title, really, for the fact that most people these days associate humanism with sort of an ethical form of atheism or something like that. Mm. And indeed, you know, the British Humanist Association website says that it works on behalf of non-religious people who seek to live ethical lives on the basis of reason and humanity.
Mm.
And that might be a good description, you know, if someone were to look for a description of how they live their life and they don't really believe in God. They might say, yeah, sign me up. That sounds right. Yeah, we need to live our lives on the basis of reason and humanity and live ethical lives. Don't need God for that. Fair enough. If you want to have your Sunday time, Theo, and that helps you to live a good life, great. But the rest of us don't really need it. So, yeah, what do you say to that?
Well, yeah, that's an incredibly strong cultural assumption that we've lived in for decades now, is that you can have this humanism without religion and so on. And in a sense, it's true. In a sense, people do, as I've just said. They do. They are capable of having a humanistic outlook and so on. But I suppose I'm trying to unsettle that a bit, to dig a bit deeper and to say, hang on, where do those values come from? What do you mean that you're humanist? What's the basis of that? Where does it come from? How deep does it go? Is it conforming with the culture around you, or is it something you've thought through for yourself? Mm-hmm. Do you have some sort of explanation for why this is the right way to be human? Mm-hmm. And I think, in a sense, our culture dissuades people from thinking about these really basic questions. Just because it's in the air, just because it's taken for granted that civilized people are going to have these rational humanist outlooks. So we do need to be a little bit kind of back to basics, a little bit naively kind of digging down and saying, well, hang on, why? Why do you think this? What do you really think?
I mean, you dig into what some of the prominent voices in atheism have been saying recently on this front, and you haven't found them very persuasive. So A.C. Grayling wrote a book, sort of The Argument for God, I think it was called, or The Argument Against God, and it was his case both against theism and for humanism.
Yes, I think that was a good example of the assumption that atheists make, is that there is built into atheism a sort of humanism, that if you're going to just look rationally at the world, you're going to have humanist ideas about
it. They'll just naturally spring up.
Once you think rationally, you'll see the truth of humanism. And I'm trying to say, well, hang on, is that the case? Does rationalism lead to humanism?
And Before we go any further, let's define humanism for people who maybe are thinking, well, what exactly is this? And why is it not necessarily something that is automatically something we would get to, left to our own devices?
Well, I would define it as a belief in universal human rights, the equality of all human beings, the desire to see all humans flourishing, and so on. Now, in a weaker form, you could say, well, that comes naturally. It's altruism. It's looking after people in your social group and so on. But I'm suggesting that a more hardcore humanism is this universal form of it that emerges in modern times that overcomes the more tribal form of grouping and says that even that distant person in a foreign land is a fellow human that should care about equally to our own kind.
And if there's a culture where they're not abiding by these human rights, China, for instance, or somewhere else, then they should be. This is
right. There is a sort of bossy side to it, of this is the right way to be, and this can reform the world. There is a sort of evangelical agenda to it, that this is the true ideology that it would be good for all human societies to know about. So I think that's broadly how I define humanism.
And the contention is, of people like A.C. Grayling, an atheist philosopher, that we don't need religion or Christianity to get to that point of view. If we just look at the world rationally, scientifically, that's the natural conclusion we'll come to. But
That's what the atheists say. They make this assumption that I think is very feeble and flimsy, which is that this humanist ideology comes naturally to human beings once they think straight, once they get rid of nasty prejudices and bigotry and superstitions and so on. Once that falls away, this is the natural form of civilized humanity. Now, I think that that can't be taken very seriously, because if you look at history and if you look at current affairs, obviously human societies are not all dominated by this rational humanism. Yeah. So in reality, they are representing one tradition in history, which comes out of the West, the Enlightenment, and I would say the Christian-based Enlightenment. But they can't admit that, because they have to claim that it flows from rational thought.
We'll come back to this in a couple of minutes' time. We're going to go to a break, and, and we'll keep talking about humanism, atheism, Christianity, and whether at the end of the day humanism needs God, and some of the other things you draw out in the book about that. My guest today is Theo Hobson. He's the author of God Created Humanism, The Christian Basis of Secular Values, published by SBCK. He's my guest today on The Profile, and we're going to be continuing to dig into this. If you want to read more interviews with other interesting people like Theo, then why not visit the website of our magazine, premierchristianity.com. ad/freesample in order to get a free sample copy of the latest edition of the magazine. And we'll be back in a few minutes' time with the next part of today's show.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Profile interview with me, Justin Brierley, brought to you as part of Faith Explored every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio. And if you want to find more interviews online with various people who have joined myself and others for the Profile, we of course have a podcast now. You can go and visit that at the website premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. And The Profile brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. It's a monthly title. I'm the senior editor. And if you'd like to find out more about it, do go to our website as well, premierchristianity.com. But that's enough of websites and things like that. Let me remind you who I'm talking to on The Profile today. It's Theo Hobson. He's a freelance journalist. He's the author of a new book as well, God Created Humanism, The Christian Basis of Secular Values. And in the first half of the show, he talked to us a little bit about his own faith journey growing up and the way he's sort of had this love-hate relationship with the church, but in the end has managed to settle on it as an imperfect institution still able to do a lot of good in the world. But turning his attention now to whether the claims of humanism, secular humanism in particular, are all they're cracked up to be. And we sort of were talking about the fact that many of the leading voices these days, Theo, in that realm, are talking about the idea that, well, if we would just concentrate on rationalism, science, get rid of prejudice and religion, we'd sort of head towards this secular nirvana. You know, you mentioned in the book, it's a bit like what John Lennon sang about in Imagine, you know, imagine there's no heaven and we'll all end up with some brotherhood of man. You're a bit sceptical of that. It doesn't look like that's what always happens when that happens. And you, I think maybe we need to go back to the basics here of what the West is. This is the context which most of these people are speaking from. And like you say, there's a kind of an assumption about the values we all hold dear, equality, human dignity, and so on. Not necessarily, though, I guess, something that had to emerge in our culture.
Yeah, I think it is there in our culture, and I think it is the real basic creed that we share in the West. And I think the problem is that we don't have a way of reflecting on it well enough. We are actually very evasive and, in a sense, embarrassed about talking about what I call secular humanism, which is our basic creed in the West, human rights and so forth. And for some reason that in a sense is quite surprising, but it's not really reflected on very often or very well, because of course we're all fighting over details about political policies and so on, and it's a difficult thing for us to stand back and say, look, we do have an ideology in the West and it's a good ideology. And in a sense, that's the starting point of my book, is just to say, first of all, let's look at that and ask what it is.
And you build a case, as we've mentioned, that that ideology is very firmly rooted in a Judeo-Christian heritage, that it didn't just wouldn't have just sprung up regardless, that in fact, you know, if you look at other parts of the world which haven't been influenced necessarily, you won't necessarily find the same kinds of rights and dignities.
That's right. I do argue that it is a particular tradition. And in a way, that's the thing that we are reluctant to face up to, secular people at least, is that this ideology is not just natural, it's not just there, it's not just rational, but it is this very long brewing tradition that came through the Christian centuries and especially in the Enlightenment period and so on. And that's something that's difficult to think about, because in a post-Enlightenment world, we're wary of tradition. We don't want to seem limited. We want to feel like all individuals can naturally access the truth just through thinking. And it feels limiting to say we are indebted to these centuries and centuries of tradition and we come out of this story. So I'm trying to say, look, there is this story in which secular humanism does gradually emerge from Christian thought over the centuries. And that also leads us to quite a complicated question of how Christianity is now related to secular
yes.
humanism.
Yes, because in a sense, it's not that you're against secular humanism, per se. No,
quite the opposite. I say it's the right public ideology. It's a providential thing, if you like, that we have this public creed in which we are united by a form of universalism that does not need to take account of religion. It leaves religion to one side and it says, let's talk about our common humanity in a way that can unite us. And that involves secularism. So I affirm secularism in the sense of leaving religion to one side and doing politics in a secular way. The complicated thing is, how can you affirm that and also affirm Christianity?
Yes, absolutely. You have an analogy in the book about the icing on the cake and the cake itself. So do you just want to draw that out?
I said that secular humanism is the icing on the religious cake, which means that it's a necessary top-level thing that's, in a sense, superficial, but it's based on these long centuries of Christianity. And I'm trying to say that we need both things. You need to affirm the secular humanism that has emerged in fairly recent times. And also, if you're a Christian, of course, you need to affirm Christianity that it's based on. And the complexity is that you can't merge them together. You can't make one big ideology and say, let's have Christian humanism as the truth which we should try and make everyone agree with. Because, of course, then you wouldn't be having the secular freedom in which you treat people of other religions or no religion as equal. So it's important to have this, in a sense, double vision or two-pronged approach in which you affirm secular humanism as the right political ideology, but also you say, well, we also need Christianity because that's where it all comes from, that's the true engine of it.
When you say we need it, though, I suppose the humanist, the secularist, will turn around and say, well, I'm not saying get rid of Christianity. If you want to have your Christian faith, by all means, just don't let it interfere with our secular values and the way we run society. And that's what we're campaigning against when we don't want the bishops in the House of Lords and we don't want faith schools.
Well, I have a lot of sympathy with them. I've often made sort of liberal Christian noises of saying we do need to reform certain traditions that don't really allow for secular freedom. But on the other hand, I would like those secularists to acknowledge that our common creed is not simply non-religious, it's not simply humanist or atheist, but it does come out of these centuries of religion. So it's quite a subtle.
I have a feeling what they'll push back with. Mm. So let me be the devil's advocate, for want of a better word. Is look, the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You'll find that in all kinds of cultures and religions and ethical systems. It's not you know, just Christianity that told us that. So they might say, you know, actually, that's something that's obviously just a human thing. That's a humanly recognised thing. You don't need a particular religion to manifest that. And that, I suppose, is a fairly basic sort of idea in humanism. You know, recognising the humanity of another person, and you want the same treatment as you would expect for yourself.
Yes, and of course, there is some truth to that, but not quite enough, I would say, because in reality, these other traditions which talk about the golden rule, it's a pretty weak rule. It doesn't really challenge traditions of hierarchy. It doesn't really challenge tribalism. If you look at ancient China, where Confucius and people were talking about this rule, if you look at ancient Greece, where some philosophers were talking about this rule, it doesn't really have the power to change society.
They were still societies that ran on slavery.
Exactly. Exactly. It's only the Judeo-Christian tradition that has this kind of revolutionary energy that says this principle of universal love must overthrow these tribal traditions, these hierarchy traditions, these legal traditions. A lot of it is about the law, the ritual, and the law that controls how we're moral and so on. So a lot of these ancient traditions which talk about the golden rule, what they really mean is up to a point, to a point that doesn't threaten our social order. You see the same thing in Islam.
Yeah. And from that point of view, if you're kind of just trying to get people to recognize that Christianity is somewhat unique in having been able to actually affect the kind of change and social change and bringing us into this stage where we really hold these values dear and they make a difference. I mean, if the secularist just turns around and says, all right, I take your point, Theo, it is thanks to Christianity, but we don't need Christianity anymore. It's, you know, it's served its purpose. Thank you that it helped us to get here, but now we're here. Mm. We've kind of transcended it.
Yeah.
And so what's
I think that is a very common kind of agnostic position that says, in the past, yes, maybe we came out of Christian centuries, but now we don't need it anymore. I think that can be rebutted by saying, even in quite recent history, this is how the humanist ideal has really been energized. If you look at civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, and so on, there is still a need for this intense Christian vision to really animate
but
it.
You'll have like Christopher Hitchens telling you, he just used Christian imagery, Martin Luther King, for the civil rights movement, but it was actually just about a humanist kind of agenda. It wasn't a religious thing deep down with him. That's what I've heard.
Well, I think that argument, you know, is not even worth responding to. It supplies its own rope to hang itself. It's so absurd. You know, this man was a preacher talking about religion. So to claim he's not to be religion is just funny. And you also see it in the emergence of human rights in the mid-20th century and so on. There are provable Christian bases to a lot of these humanist expressions. And also, if you look at progressive politics quite recently, its main charismatic figures have had strong links with Christianity. If you look at Obama, for example, and others in the West, there still is this sense that the Christian basis of humanism is still what really drives its most intense, daring forms.
Again, I'm playing devil's advocate, just to challenge you on this. But again, I could imagine the comeback being, all right, so yes, there's been some good examples of religious people who have driven forward a progressive social agenda and so on. But equally, you know, there were the slave owners who justified slavery from the Bible. There, you know, many secularists would argue that Christianity has been a break on types of progress, inclusion of women and so on. So it cuts both ways, I suppose.
Yes. I mean, of course, there's valid arguments to be had there. But I think what I would do there is just to question the assumptions of the humanist there and say, why do you think these values are what we should be promoting? And to look back a bit in their history and where they've come from. And you might find that they'll probably claim to come from Enlightenment humanism. So I think we can look at that, which means going back into the history of ideas and saying, well, what about that tradition? Where did that come from, of secular thinkers, rational thinkers? And I think there's a strong case for saying, well, they were influenced by the Christian morality around them. So if you trace it back, you can find these roots to humanist thinking.
I mean, the Enlightenment, as it's called, it's a bit of a nebulous idea, but essentially that's where a lot of people who might call themselves secularists, atheists today would say that's when we learnt to disestablish sort of religion from, you know, all the spheres of life that it once occupied, and we were able to kind of ditch some of the superstitious thinking and that kind of thing. You know, it was really in the Enlightenment that we were able to do science properly and to be able to start to think outside of religious categories and so on. But you're saying if you think of the Enlightenment as somehow we kind of left Christianity behind at that point, that's not quite true, because the Enlightenment itself was a product of...
Right, they were Christians, most of the early Enlightenment thinkers.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were what I would call semi-Christian deists, which means they believed in a rational idea of God. They stepped away from the revelation side of religion. So they weren't exactly Christians, but they were not exactly atheists either. They were acknowledging their belonging to this tradition of morality as defined by God. And of course, the Christian God was how their idea of the moral God was formed. So, as I say, a lot of them were actual Christians as well. So it's a bit of a myth put forward by atheists that there was this clean break, maybe in the 17th or 18th century, from religion to secular humanism, atheism. In reality, these things came out of Protestant culture in particular. And in a lot of cases, they were driven by very committed Protestants, especially in the sphere of politics, because the first real challenges to what you could call theocracy or Christendom, the idea of religion and politics being the same thing, these came from reformers, radical reformers, people like Anabaptists, who denounced the whole idea of worldly religion and the church and so on. They were the real inventors of the idea of religious liberty. And of course, then it was secularized a bit and so on. So the real history of ideas is not as the atheist humanists would have us believe.
I mean, returning to our atheist humanist of today, who says, well, or very well, glad we got here in the end, but that all we need now is the icing on the cake. We don't need the cake underneath anymore. I mean, why for you are you going to say, no, let's not just jettison the cake? Because is it that what we do have in terms of a secular humanist philosophy isn't deep enough?
That's right. That's exactly right. It is superficial because it makes an assumption that this ideology of humanism can be done in a rational way, in a sensible way, in a moderate way. Whereas in reality, if you look at this tradition of humanism, it comes out of this incredibly idealistic vision of the world being put right. It comes out of this perfectionist vision of all humanity being transformed, of suffering being cured, of the kingdom of God, in a secular sense, on earth. Now, that's their basic dishonesty, I would call it, that they do not admit this force of positive vision. They cut it down. They have
and
it within
do you think
reason.
They're not entitled to it in an atheist sort of framework? In a framework where, say, we're talking about all that exists is a universe of blind forces and matter in motion, are they not entitled to have a purpose, an event? You know, this is where humanity, this is the goal of humanity. Because what the British humanists will come back with is, we make our own meaning, Theo. I accept, you know, the kingdom of God stuff you're talking about, that was nice, but it's just us now. We're on our own, so we've got to make the best of it.
Right. Well, that's a argument to be taken very seriously. But then when they say, and our values are humanist and so on, that is the time to say, well, what do you mean? Where does that come from? And
they'll say it comes from within me, Theo. I've recognized I may be a random product of the universe, but I fortunately have developed this capacity for self-reflection and realized that the best way for us all to get on together is to be humans.
Well, I mean, I don't totally dismiss that tradition of thought, because it does come out of the Enlightenment rationalism that has this universalism in it. And in a sense, it was a good thing that it emerged, this idea of the rational human being, the universal vision of morality. And that's the sort of thing they're still in the tradition of. They're still in the tradition of, you know, Voltaire and Locke and people like this. And in a sense, that's a good tradition. So I don't completely knock them and think they're terrible charlatans or anything. I think it's been a very important force in creating where we are now. And it's a good tradition, the secular humanist tradition that they are part of. But if they start getting beyond that bounds and saying, therefore, religion is something to be moved away from, then of course it's a different matter.
Okay. Do you feel like if, say, the West continues on the trajectory it's on, which appears to be, at present at least, away from religion, the rise, you know, we're seeing the rise both in the US and across Europe of the nuns, those who don't claim any religious affiliation, obviously the decline of church going, and is it being replaced by essentially secular humanism? And if that continues, will that be fine? Will we just sort of manage with that? Or do you think it's going to have repercussions, sort of being divorced from the religious underpinnings?
I think there's a problem with moving away from the religious basis of it, and that it will therefore become less coherent, secular humanism. It will become more fragile. It will become less sure of itself. I think we're already seeing that. We're seeing it in populist reactions against mainstream progressive politics. The idea of openness to the world, that nationalism is a dubious thing, that we should have moved beyond. You know, that sort of thing is being challenged.
Are we talking about Donald Trump?
Yeah,
and,
we are.
And his travel ban, for instance, is that where
that
we're...
sort of thing? Yeah, those movements are looking stronger than they did a decade or two ago, and that's potentially worrying. And I think it really signals a loss of nerve in the Western ideology, that there's a sense of, we don't know how to defend our core values of universal humanism and so on. And of course, they are difficult to defend because they are so idealistic. They're so intense to believe that every human being on the planet is equal. You're always going to fail. You're always going to...
And what right have you to say over Donald Trump's America First slogans that, no, Donald, you should value every human life equally? Are you saying that we've kind of lost the kind of the impetus to make that moral claim?
Well, I think it's still there in the American tradition, thankfully, that there is a deep sort of liberal idealism that we saw with Obama, and it hasn't disappeared just because this man didn't quite win the popular vote. You know, it's a reaction. I think it's still a reaction against the dominant creed. So I would say that the West still does have this dominant creed, which is very healthy, of secular humanism and so on. But it's a bit shakier
than it was.
And that's partly about its failure to reflect on itself, its failure to see where it comes from. And that lands it into problems of articulation.
So what do you think is the role of the church going forward? Because in some ways you don't, I imagine, want to go back to a theocracy, obviously. That we're not looking to for the church to be this sort of top-down dictatorial kind of force on society. But you obviously don't want to see the church pushed out altogether either when it comes to the impact it has.
Right. Well, yes.
Small question, but how do you steer that line then going forward?
Yeah, of course, I affirm a liberal idea of the church. I think that it should very much affirm this creed of secular humanism. It should say this is the right way for society to be, and that religion works within that as a form of culture that can hopefully influence people to a large extent. And so my thesis is obviously very much against a theocratic unity of religion and politics thing, but it's also saying Christians should be able to affirm that. They shouldn't be threatened by that in a way that still a lot of Christians are in our society. They think if we're losing our last bits of cultural power, then it might all be over, so we must hang on to it. I'm saying, no, we need to, in a sense, give up that whole mindset and affirm the good in secularism. And of course, that's the direction that the churches have roughly been taken for many decades.
Sometimes by force, it's not necessarily always by choice that the church has given up its privileges in society. But as that increasingly happens, and what is the role then for the church? Is it to just sort of be a nice place to go on a Sunday, or do you think it does have a sort of important role in the infrastructure and the way society runs?
Well, I think it must try to be an attractive form of culture that talks a lot about the humanist values we all share, and it shows itself to be, in a sense, the engine of that humanism.
The source of those values.
Yeah, the source of those values. And to a large extent, it does that by being prominent in certain social campaigns and political campaigns, and by at least most parts of the church talking a lot about human rights and so on. So I think to a large extent, it's doing okay with that, of showing itself to be the source of the humanism that the rest of us share. There's also other things it needs to do differently, I think, partly about how it relates to culture and how it needs to be more creative and, in a sense, move away from some of its old models.
Yeah. And to that extent, my view is, and you're welcome to disagree, is that for me, we can, you know, humanist, Christian, whatever, we can all probably agree on a certain set of values that we all hold common. The problem is whether that inspires enough to go out and do that and actually make a difference. And what I do tend to see Christianity do is it makes people go and do stuff. You know, it is often the churches who are running the food banks, the homeless shelters. Now, I'm not saying atheists and humanists don't do that. I'm sure they do. But nonetheless, the church does seem to have a record in actually inspiring people to live out the values that they profess.
Yes, I think it does. And I think in very sort of quiet ways, it's there making a difference to culture. I think the witness of, you know, sensible, clever priests just who are part of all sorts of institutions and so on is very important thing that's not remarked upon much, but it does have an influence on who we are as a society.
Yeah. It's been great to talk to you, Theo. Thank you very much again. The book is available now, God Created Humanism, The Christian Basis of Secular Values. And it's published by SBCK. If you want to listen back to today's programme, I'll remind you, premierchristianradio.com/the profile. You can pick up the podcast there and listen to other episodes of the show as well. And you can also hear and watch and indeed read more interviews at the Premier Christianity magazine website. That's premierchristianity.com. I've been Justin Briley, your host for today's show. Theo Hobson, thank you for joining me on The Profile.
Thanks very much.